The search for solutions to the problem of homelessness continues, and as parties explore a variety of solutions, they can agree on one thing. There's no single answer. We had an extended discussion yesterday of the Honolulu City Council's efforts to expand the so-called sit-lie ban, Hawaii County's pilot safe zones project, and the difficulty of getting an accurate assessment of the homeless population, a discussion in which several listeners called in to take part. Scott Morishige, the state's homeless coordinator, joins us this morning to review some of the highlights of that discussion and give us the state's perspective. And Scott, we definitely didn't want to have this discussion without you taking part in it. You weren't able to be with us yesterday, but it was you can probably expect it was a pretty lively discussion, yeah?
Yeah, no, and thank you for the opportunity to join you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Well, sure. And I assume you agree with what I said, but there's no one solution, right?
Oh, yes. No, I mean, homelessness is such a complex issue. There's no one answer. And you're dealing with many different, populations of people who fall into homelessness for many different reasons.
Yeah.
So it's something that didn't develop overnight to get to the point where we are, and it's something that's not going to be solved overnight either.
Well, let's look at where we are today from the state's perspective. Do you have an idea, like a ballpark idea of the state's population, for example?
So, according to the most recent homeless point-in-time count, the 2017 point-in-time count that was done in January, mm-hmm. there's about 7,200 homeless individuals statewide. Mm-hmm. And this is actually a reduction from where we were in the prior year in 2016. And I think one of the things that's important to note is that we actually saw the first statewide decrease in homelessness, a decrease of 9%, first decrease we've seen in 8 years. So I think we have to acknowledge that there has been some progress in reducing the number of people who are experiencing homelessness throughout the state of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I think with that being said, one thing that we've seen when we look at the data is although the overall numbers of homeless individuals are going down, we're seeing an increase in people who are unsheltered homeless. So people not staying in shelter, but who are homeless, actually living literally out of doors.
Under a tree on a park bench.
Or, and that number has been going up. So I think we need to figure out why that's occurring and how we can really work with the resources we have to target that situation. Because I think that's something people can see not only in the data, but when you look around us in our community, we do see people living in encampments, and that's not acceptable. So we need to figure out how we can work with our resources to address that situation and get people off the streets to a place of long-term stability.
Scott, you were telling me about some of the conditions you found. For example, tell me about what's happening under Nimitz Viaduct in Honolulu.
So under the Nimitz Viaduct, the Department of Transportation is going to do a cleanup of that area starting next week, Monday the 23rd.
A sweep.
Yeah, yes. So we went with outreach providers yesterday, and we're going to be going out to the remainder of this week to give notification and connect people to services in that area. But you have people living in situations that are really unsafe. There are a number of people living on the water in the Moanalua Stream, on houseboats. You have people who are living in the rafters of the viaduct. There was a fire that occurred in the area as recently as Friday. There's reasons why certain areas on government property are closed to all members of the public. Mm-hmm. This is not something specifically targeting homeless individuals. These areas are closed off to the public for health and safety reasons just in general. And government does have an obligation to respond when people are in situations that are dangerous. When we go out, we always partner with social service providers, with outreach agencies, so we can link people who are without homes, without a place to stay, to shelter services and long-term support. That's always our goal.
I'm trying to imagine, living in rafters under the viaduct, that the sanitation has got to be almost non-existent.
Yeah, it's, there are situations there where you have people living right next to large piles of trash.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't necessarily toilet or other sanitation facilities in that area.
Got to be rats, right?
I'm sure there are. I've encountered rats are very large in some of the encampments that we've gone to in the past. And when you think these are conditions that people are sleeping in, right? So when we go out, what we're trying to do is build a relationship with the people who are there, let them know that some of the circumstances with our state shelters and other programs have changed, where the state and the city and county have begun to work really hard to lower the barriers to entry. For example, in the past, someone wanting to go to an emergency shelter, you had to have a picture ID to get in. That's no longer a requirement for most of the shelters. There were other things that served as barriers, and we're working through our state contracts to try and address that and make our shelters more accessible for people to come in more easily.
I want to play a soundbite from a caller yesterday. This is Mark from the North Shore, who I believe this is the man who had worked in San Francisco on the homeless issue. Let's just hear what he had to say.
I have not heard one single caller talk about the cause of homelessness. And what we learned in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'll be very brief here, we divided the problem into three categories. Category one, identification of people who truly do not want to be homeless. Maybe they're working poor, et cetera. Pump resources into getting them off the streets and into housing. Category two, a truthful acknowledgement that some people you cannot save. And then category three, 75 to 80% of your resources need to go to cutting off the cancer. Stop trying to treat the cancer. How about identifying a cure? So in San Francisco, we did a comprehensive study, and we learned that the number one contributor, believe it or not, in the San Francisco Bay Area was the foster care system. Kids emancipated at age 18 had nowhere to go. They're kicked out on the streets. That was the number one feeder into homelessness in the Bay Area. So what do? We changed the whole foster care system so that kids have resources when they emancipate, and that greatly reduced the numbers going into homelessness.
Scott, are you finding that there are young kids coming out of the foster family environment?
I think that's one factor that we're seeing. Certainly, I think in Kakaaka Waterfront Park, there were youth, you know, young people who were living in the park. Some of them were runaways. Some of them who did have parents living in the park, but parents that were really not caring for them. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think the state has been working very hard on, though, through the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health, is to adopt a new way that we work with families, including foster youth in the system. We've adopted an approach called Ohana Nui, which means really addressing the extended family, not just focusing on child, but looking at their whole system of supports and trying to wrap services around the child. Recently, Department of Human Services also extended the age a child can receive support through age 21. So this is something I think the department is trying to target resources to address. But there's many other systemic causes of homelessness as well. One of the things that we know is many individuals who are living out of doors who are chronically homeless are people who are dealing with serious mental illness or addiction. And so one of the things the administration did work very hard with the legislature last session was to increase resources for those who have serious mental illness, so we can specifically target people who are unsheltered, bring resources to them.
Yeah.
Beginning in, I think, May of this year, Department of Health launched an intensive case management pilot in partnership with Queens Hospital and the Honolulu Police Department to target those individuals who have serious mental illness, who are frequently going through the emergency room or frequently being what they call MH1'd by HPD, being brought in to Queens for a psychiatric assessment, trying to target those individuals for very intensive case management services. And that, although that pilot project is fairly new, it seems to have had very positive results, at least in terms of reducing the level of recidivism for emergency room usage for that population.
And that was what the caller was referring to, that the candid acknowledgement that there are people who are just not almost beyond the reach of standard efforts to help them, right? Mm-hmm. Another caller, you mentioned Kaka'ako Waterfront Park, and let's hear what Michelle from Kaneohe said about that.
Kaka'ako Waterfront Park was the last straw for me. It's like surfers can't go there. People, families can't go there. The other situation over on King Street where Stadium Park is, that's another untenable situation. What I would love to see is not only safe zones, but I would like to see some vagrancy laws with some teeth where the city and county coordinate with the state instead of the city and county and state constantly fighting with each other and pointing fingers at each other.
What do you think about that? I mean, it seems to move in two different directions, her suggestion. Tougher laws, vagrancy laws, which can be accused of criminalizing homelessness, with safe zones, which sort of moves in a different direction. Yeah.
Well, I think one thing, you know, she mentioned coordination or lack of coordination between the city and county and the state.
Yeah.
And one thing I did want to say is both the city and the state, we actually do coordinate pretty closely. When we receive calls from the public, a lot of times people, you know, don't know about jurisdiction or they don't care about jurisdiction. So we get calls that come in, sometimes are for city and county properties and vice versa. And I regularly talk to my counterpart, Mark Alexander, at the city and county. Mm-hmm. We share information. We collaborate, figure out how we can combine our resources together. I also think the caller brought up a good point about, you know, when situations start to impact public safety, again, I think government does have an obligation to respond.
Right.
And we need to provide our state agencies that manage parks or other public spaces, like Department of Transportation that manages the roadways, what the tools they need to address the situation. So, for example, Governor Ige, this past session, one of the things we did do is we worked with Department of Transportation to increase resources so the legislature was able to provide funding for them to address enforcement issues on state highways. Mm-hmm. So that we're able to respond to some encampments that were in really unsafe situations where they were literally overlooking the H1 freeway and at risk of falling into the roadway.
Mm-hmm.
So we work with them to increase level of funding for Department of Transportation. We also work with the legislature to close loopholes in our law that allows our state law enforcement to better address criminal trespass on state lands.
Yeah.
And as a result, in late July, Department of Transportation was able to start addressing some of these unsafe situations along the H1 corridor from Middle Street to Kahala and mm-hmm. along the Nimitz corridor from River Street to Sand Island. And there, it was estimated there were about 80 people living along those areas in late July. And we were able to connect over the past several months 62 of those people into shelter and housing, and also able to clear some of those situations where people were, again, literally above the roadway. But it takes dedicated commitment of resources and really giving the agencies that manage these properties the tools they need to do so. As we prepare for the 2018 legislative session, that's one of the things that we're discussing as well. How can we continue to provide the tools not only to the Department of Transportation, but to agencies like the Hawaii Community Development Authority that manages the Kaka'ako Parks,
So
that they have the tools they need to keep these public spaces open and accessible for the public. Because they have an obligation to the whole community to keep these public spaces as public spaces.
Well, Scott, as that listener just said, for her, Kaka'ako District Park was the last straw. Let's, just for benefit of, you know, Neighbor Island listeners who might not mm-hmm. know, but let's review how that situation, what it is today and how it came about.
So one of the things people have to remember when you're looking at the Kaka'ako situation, if we've had a homeless population in Kaka'ako, I want to say for at least a decade, and I think it goes back to maybe about 11 years ago or so when Ala Moana Beach Park was actually closed down for mm-hmm. a period of time, and the homeless population who was residing there was pushed out of that area. And that was when you first started seeing homeless individuals in the Kaka'ako mm-hmm. area. Since then, there's been a pretty persistent encampment. I think 2 years ago, shortly before I started in my position with the state, that encampment in Kaka'ako Makai had reached proportions where it was 300-plus people, and it was very unsafe. HPD was responding on a pretty regular basis to assaults and different types of things in the area. You know, state and city and county coordinated together to get people, you know, connected from that area to shelter, to housing, and also to clear the situation that had developed. Unfortunately, some individuals did relocate to Kaka'ako Waterfront Park. And what led HCDA to have to close the park recently is there was just a high level of damage to the park. You have almost all of the lampposts were tampered with. You have live electrical wires exposed. Yeah. browned out grass in many of the areas of the park, and there were multiple fires. So again, the park being closed is only, it's temporary to allow HCDA to go in, assess the level of damage, and the goal is to bring back the parks online to the public as quickly as possible. But it was closed for health and safety reasons because the park is no longer a safe place due to the level of damage that resulted.
Roughly how many in that population are children?
So one of the things that we were very happy to be able to report is that when we went with outreach providers into Kaka'ako Waterfront Park the week prior to the park closure, we were able to get connected to shelter all the families with minor children in that park. Mm-hmm. So that was about 28 individuals altogether in those families, and we were able to connect them to shelter and housing. Since then, we've been able to connect about 40 people altogether from the Kaka'ako Waterfront Park mm-hmm. area to shelter and housing. I think there were 4 people that went directly into permanent housing through housing vouchers available from service providers.
You know, I'm sure, Scott, you get any number of opportunities to assess what's being done in other venues, other mm-hmm. states, other locations. I do want to bring in a soundbite from yesterday. Lance Niimi, a special assistant to mm-hmm. Hawaii Island, Mayor Harry Kim, talking about what they've done on the Kona side.
We had an airport, Kona Airport, where our homeless had built up a large number of camps and people, and people were asking us to restore the park so that the people could be using it again for their families and taken to the beach like they used to and have walks in the morning and feel safe.
What do you think of the whole safe zones idea, Scott?
One of the things is my office and the Hawaii Interagency Council on Homelessness, we're actually tasked by the legislature this past session through Act 212 to form a working group to look at the issue of safe zones. And we're really taking that mandate very seriously. So we actually had a working group meeting last week, Thursday, where we were able to get input from people in the community, including Lance and his staff at Hawaii County, and homeless individuals themselves to get their thoughts and get their feedback. One of the things that we're looking at is we have such a limited amount of resources to address homelessness in general, so we do need to look at costs. Mm-hmm. And one of the things for the encampment Camp Kikaha in Kona is the cost right now, I think, is estimated at a little over $21,000 per month. And when you break it down by the number of people who are staying there at any given time, that's about $800 to $900 a month per mm-hmm. person. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we do need to take into consideration. But we have also looked at other legal encampments across the country in places like Oregon or Seattle, for example, looking at Opportunity Village and Nicholsville, and those have a lower per person cost. So we're weighing all those different types of factors right now.
Any number of factors to be weighed in, right? Here's a quick quote from Senator Sparrow. He's the chair of the Housing Committee at the legislature, about the transient nature of the homeless population.
The idea, of course, is to help these individuals. And we can't help them if they're roaming like nomads all over the island. Let's put them in one place where the resources are available and we could help them.
And that's obviously the rationale for safe zones of it. As I listened to that, I did wonder, from the perspective of a homeless person, being discussed in terms of let's put them in one place. A lot of people are homeless for one reason or another because they don't want to be put anywhere by someone else, right?
Yeah, and I think when you look at the concept of a shelter, what an emergency shelter is, I think initially emergency shelters develop for the same purpose, right? So you have a designated place in the community where people can go to be connected to resources. Now we're having a situation where people experiencing homelessness in the community are saying that many of them have concern about going to shelter. You know, government, we're trying to work hard to lower those barriers to shelter entry. But I think because you have this population who are saying they're not going to go into shelter, now we've had this big push to establish legal encampments or safe zones. But the challenge is if people are reluctant to leave the area where they're staying to go to an emergency shelter, we have to consider, is there going to be that same type of reluctance to go to a safe zone or legal encampment that may be in a part of the island that's very far away or not convenient for them? So that, mm-hmm. that's something that the working group that's looking at this issue has to take into consideration as well.
Well, Scott, I really appreciate you being with us this morning. I don't think too many people envy you your job.
No, thank you for the opportunity. And if anyone ever wants to contact my office, we're always open to getting feedback from the public. You can call us at 586-0193, or you can email my office at any time at gov.homelessness@hawaii.gov.
Thanks very much for being with us, Scott. Scott Morishige serves as the governor's coordinator on homelessness and is the point person for homeless issues in state government.
Technology is advancing faster than a lot of us can comprehend, so how do we separate the good from the not so good?
There are pretty bad worst case scenarios, but if you can just trust humans with the technology, things could be amazing, but that's a big if.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's not like it's the end of the world, right? Right? It's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after All Things Considered.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at marine turtle populations over a vast area of the Pacific. But first, your quiz. Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're trekking to the southern tip of the Big Island, destination Papakolea Beach. Also called Pu'u'o Mahana, this is a secluded bay in the Kau District. And after a rugged trail through jagged lava fields, you'll have to navigate steep terrain to reach the ocean. The first thing to catch your eye will be the unusual color of the sand. The beach in this area is made from olivine, also known as evening emerald, a silicate mineral containing iron and magnesium. The continual beating of the waves has eroded the nearby cinder cone, broken down the basalt lava into grassy green olivines. Beaches like these are rare, but there are actually two green sand beaches in the U.S. Can you tell us where the second one is located? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right will get our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, this is Ainoa Naniole. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
NOAA's Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center has an ambitious goal, one the public can help it meet. Its scientists are looking at more than 2 million square miles of Pacific Ocean to look at the effect of human-caused mortality on marine turtle populations. Supervisory research biologist T. Todd Jones is the lead scientist for the Marine Turtle Biology and Assessment Program, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Todd. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
There's still quite a bit to be learned about marine turtle populations, isn't there?
There is. You know, there's several populations and species of turtle across the Pacific, some increasing, some decreasing, mm-hmm. and we're still trying to understand everything from their distribution and movements, their population status and trends, and the threats that they face.
We're familiar, probably people in local waters are most familiar maybe with the green sea turtle, honu. What other species are there out there?
Well, in Hawaii, we have the green turtle and the hawksbill. And then throughout the Pacific, we also have the olive ridley sea turtle, the leatherback sea turtle, the loggerhead sea turtle, and around Australia only, we have the flatback sea turtle.
And all of these are in present in the waters that you're surveying?
Not the flatback. We don't work with the flatback, but the olive ridley, loggerhead, green, and hawksbill are turtles that we work with.
So what are the things you most want to know?
From the standpoint of NOAA, under the Endangered Species Act, we're largely looking at the population status, so presence and absence of turtles. And then once we understand where they are, we want to understand their abundance, how many, not just the habitats they use, but how many turtles there are for a particular population, and then the trend. Is that population increasing or decreasing?
Yeah.
And that's the important part, is the increasing or decreasing.
Sure.
And if it's decreasing, what are the threats that are facing that population? As endangered and threatened species, we're mandated to actually work towards resiliency of these populations to reduce the threats and have them either be in a steady state or recovering.
Of threats largely coming from human impacts?
There are major human impacts, which can be anything from a direct take of marine turtles to habitat loss, nesting habitat loss, and to interactions with commercial activities, including fisheries.
A lot of them have the same nesting habitat, is that right?
So turtles always want to nest on sort of a sandy beach area. Hawksbill turtles will nest in really unique places that can be more rocky or corally. Green sea turtles typically like a nice sand beach. Leatherback turtles will go very high up into the dunes, whereas an olive ridley will be closer to the high tide line. And when an olive ridley makes a nest, you can't even tell it was ever there. It pats it down and smooths it over.
Uh-huh.
When a leatherback's done making a nest, it looks like a bomb went off. There's just craters everywhere, sand thrown everywhere. They're all unique. They're marine turtles, but they're unique. Some eat jellyfish. Some eat seagrass. There's a lot of activity.
All of which adds to the challenge of doing any kind of assessment of the population, right?
A lot of variables and parameters that come into understanding the populations.
So what kind of tools are available to you?
The classic tool for ecology is capture, mark, recapture. So you're conducting a survey, and you capture an animal. It could be a hand capture, or if the animal's basking on the beach or nesting. And then you mark the animal. It could be a microchip. It could be a flipper tag, a tag that goes onto the animal. Or in the case of some of our research, you do a marking of the shell, maybe a temporary mark. And that's how we get at numbers, how many animals there are. And so when you conduct another survey and you observe a certain amount of turtles, how many of those animals had you already seen? So that's mm-hmm. a capture, mark, recapture. That also helps us with growth rates. When you have a recapture of an animal, you understand how fast they're growing. What would be their residency time? How long do they live in a certain area before they become mature? And then how long are they mature? How often do they reproduce? These are all based in the classic animal observation survey and mark.
And this is where the public comes in.
This is where the public comes in. We have a unique opportunity with the honu, with the Hawaiian green turtle. And many might know this, but the Hawaiian green turtle that you see in the main Hawaiian Islands, 96% of the nesting takes place in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, specifically in the French Frigate Shoals. So we can have 800 to 900 females showing up on East Island, a little sand spit in the northwesterns. And they'll show up in the summertime to nest. And a female will go up there maybe once she's mature. Once every 3 to 4 years, she'll make the migration to the northwesterns. She will lay maybe 4 to 6 clutches of eggs, 100 eggs per clutch. And she'll do that about every 2 weeks, and then she'll migrate back to the main Hawaiian Islands. And since the 1980s, for almost 40 years now, we send researchers to the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And we do these surveys, these nesting beach surveys. And this past year, we actually did what we call saturation tagging. So every female and every male that came up to bass when they weren't breeding, we marked them. Mm-hmm. It's a temporary marking. It's a shell etch. So we etch their shell, which is the same as your fingernail, or the keratin like your hair.
It's going to grow out.
It's going to grow out. And so we etched a shell and we put paint in that etching, and they have a number, and that number means something to us. It could be a T in a number, which means it was on turn. It could be an M, which means it was a male. It could have a G, which means it was on gin, or a T for trig. These are the various little sand islands in French Frigate Shoals. And when someone sees that, they can actually report it. So these animals are all mostly going to come back to the main Hawaiian Islands, Oahu, Maui, the Big Island.
Yeah.
And they're going to come back to the various areas to their foraging grounds. And they'll live in about a 1 to 2 kilometer squared area where they'll rest at night in the reef under rocks, and they'll forage on the algae. And we can then link these breeding adults to their important foraging habitats. And that's the main goal here. And if people see a number, they can actually take a picture, and they can send that to respectwildlife@noaa.gov. And we, through the Citizen Science Project, we'll get valuable information on these viable adult breeders and, yeah, and where they forage.
I love the whole effect of the citizen science movement on science, and it really does, that information can be quite valuable, and you just don't have a number of people to to gather all that information, do you?
No, it's interesting. So since the 1990s, we have satellite tagged just over 20 sea turtles in northwestern Hawaiian Islands, and that's a tag that sends a signal to passing satellites, and it can tell us where the animal's moving. And so we've had 20 tags that, again, the goal was to link the animals to their important foraging habitats. We've already had over 30 reports from this last year. So we've been able to do in a month or two with the citizen scientists what took us before a couple decades to learn.
That's really that's a quantum leap, isn't it?
It is.
How far away is French Frigate Shoals? I'm interested in this whole migration. That's pretty...
Right, it's about 1,200 miles migration for the animals.
How long does it take
back? You know, it's interesting. One, for the animals that we've satellite tagged, where you actually are seeing the track of the animal, when they leave the French Frigate Shoals, they can make it back in a few days, in about 3 to 5 days, and we've seen them already coming to their home area, if you will, their home foraging area.
Demolishing the myth of the slow turtle, right?
Yes.
Thanks very much, Todd. Supervisory research biologist T. Todd Jones is the lead scientist for the Marine Turtle Biology and Assessment Program with the NOAA Fisheries Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center. You can learn more about the study on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Former state circuit court judge and U.S. attorney for the District of Hawaii has gone out of his way to undercut one of the top candidates for the job of Honolulu police chief. Stephen Alm has written the police commission to say that he and two of his predecessors as U.S. attorney did not trust Honolulu police chief candidate Tommy Ayu enough to use him as a witness in criminal cases. No one seems inclined to explain, as Louis Kanea tells us in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Puzzling story in a number of ways, because it's a very serious charge to make it a top candidate for the police chief, isn't it?
Exactly. What's at stake is pretty big, and we are kind of scratching our head as well of trying to figure out what was at underlying reasons for why they were not using him as a witness for so many years.
But essentially, an attorney doesn't use somebody as a witness if he thinks he might lie on the stand, and that's the implied charge here, isn't it?
I think that would be safe to assume, but, you know, that's not something that we can confirm at this point. And, you know, we are trying to get this particular cold case that back in 1999 when Thomas Ayew sued judge, and that has been warehoused in California, as far as we understand it. And so, you know, it takes a little while for us to get the documents, but that should explain some of the drama that went over there. That is my understanding. And so, you know, whenever we get that document, we'll sure to write about that.
Are you sued Judge Alm?
Right. For what reason exactly is still another thing that we don't know. But it was around the time that his supervisor at the DEA was trying to intervene and try to get him back on the witness stand, except that the Judge Alm, at the time, I guess he was the U.S. attorney, didn't allow that. And, you know, speculation basically is that, you know, that was one of the reasons why this lawsuit had to happen.
And Tommy Ayew was at the time in the employ of the DEA?
Right. He was a special agent for the DEA, mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, if the whole point of a special agent is to be able to testify in court, so it that's pretty much outlines just how serious this charge is. When are we likely to get some further explanation of what's going on here?
Well, either we get this document from the court, or that Thomas Ayew himself would explain to the commissioners when he's interviewed next week. That's mm-hmm. Supposed to happen. I'm not quite sure what day he will be interviewed, but interviews are scheduled for Monday through Wednesday next week. So at least commissioners might get some explanation for that. When we talked to him, you know, he basically declined to comment except to say that, you know, he will be happy to explain all this to the commissioners. And I should note also that the successor of Judge Ohm, that Ed Kubo, actually reversed that policy, basically finding that there was not sufficient reasons to continue that policy.
And did allow him to testify, although I would think that would be handing the defense attorney a good reason to undermine that testimony. Once the question is raised, right, you can always raise it again.
I would think so, too, but, you know, we didn't get to talk to Ed Kubo on that particular point, too, so we don't quite know what the reasons were or what the implications were.
Well, it's a pretty intriguing story with much more to be learned. Thanks very much for bringing it our way.
Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Louis Canella. Earlier in the show, we took off our hiking boots to wiggle our toes in the olive-hued sand at Papakolea Beach in the Kau district of Hawaii Island. The glassy volcanic beach is formed by the erosion and concentration of the semi-precious stone olivine, originating from the nearby Pu'umahana cinder cone. The ocean erodes these stones into sand. It's considered too fine to be a gem, but people have likened the experience to walking on jewels. Green sand beaches are rare, and the U.S. can boast of only two, Papakolea Beach on Hawaii Island, and the other is Talofofo Beach on Guam. Well, nobody got that today, so our bag goes wanting for the moment, but that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, history's most creative genius, Leonardo da Vinci, Walter Isaacson explores the life of the great Renaissance genius of art and science. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
There's a rising tide of bigotry in the nation against the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community, one that demands a response from the world of the arts. The The challenge is being met by a group called Artists for Social Justice, which is holding a free event this Friday called Arts in Conversation, LGBTQ+. Soprano Rachel Schutz is one of the performers. She's with us in our studio. Hi, Rachel.
Good morning, Chris.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Frequently, as artists, we feel a little bit outside of the, you know, the flow or the stream of society and not always able to have an impact, yeah?
That's right. You know, the number of times I've heard, oh, she's just a musician or she's just an actress. Why should she have an opinion?
Yeah.
I'd be a millionaire if I give you a penny for all of that. But,
but
as artists, we are part of society. We're concerned citizens as much as we are artists. And we have a medium. We have a voice of our own that we can express our opinion with. And so that's what this group is doing.
We have a medium that allows us to touch human emotions.
Absolutely. You know, and that's the beautiful thing about art is that it is open to multiple interpretations and it's a starting point. You know, it's sort of a non-aggressive way of going about and creating discussion. And that's why we call our events Arts in Conversation, because we don't want to be going in being dogmatic, telling people this is what we think, this is what you should think.
Yeah.
We want to start a conversation. We want to highlight different issues. And the arts are a fantastic way to do that.
Well, there's a great deal of temptation in any kind of issues-related discussion to be dogmatic.
Absolutely. And that's unfortunately one of the reasons that we're sort of in the situation that we are in this very divided, very divisive culture that we're living in right now, where nobody can hear the other side. Nobody has enough empathy to view things from the other side. And so this event is really a celebration event. We are not here to push an agenda. We're simply here to celebrate a group of people that have had a really important role in the arts and to highlight what effect they've had on the arts.
We've certainly seen advances, certainly over the course of my lifetime, in doing away with prejudices.
Absolutely.
Particularly in this area, you know,
absolutely.
Gay, transgender, et cetera.
Yeah, certainly don't want to deny that, absolutely. But there's work to be done. You know, we are not at an end point, if such a thing exists, in talking about prejudice and bigotry. And while it's completely admirable that we have marriage equality, for instance, that's the law of the land now.
Mm-hmm.
There are still plenty of laws on the books that can punish people for being part of this community. There's also not enough protections for especially the trans community right now. We've even seen our own president banning a whole group of people, trans people, from the military.
Yeah.
And so while we definitely want to acknowledge where we've come from and the progress we've already made, we also want to remind our audience that there's more to be done.
That particularly that military ban certainly had me wondering, and I think quite a few other people wondering about basically why.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the ostensible reasons of healthcare costs skyrocketing doesn't seem to make sense to me. It only makes sense to me from sort of a bigoted standpoint and a fear of the unknown, a fear of difference. And that's the beautiful thing about the arts is that it attracts all kinds of different people, and we get to interact with all kinds of people from all walks of life. And so we get to see that we don't have things to fear from people that are different from us, that we should be celebrating differences. And that's what this event is going to do.
Frequently, prejudices, hatreds, prejudgments about other people are based on some kind of fear.
Absolutely.
And clearly, when things like the military ban came about, it sadly tapped into a reservoir of feeling across the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
Repellent as we might find some of these things, we have to acknowledge that there was a lot of support.
Yes, very, very unfortunately. And I think that partially comes from the unknown, the different, the fact that many people maybe don't know a transgendered person, mm-hmm. and don't understand that they are just like us, just like everybody else, in that they have love, they have difficulties, they have strengths, they have weaknesses. They're just another kind of person, just like black people, white people, Asian people, women, men. men, yeah. gay, straight, we're all sort of different versions of the same human beings. And I think experience is a big thing. Having interaction with people that are different from you is a big thing. And seeing them as real human beings. And that's the point of all of our events, is to sort of humanize every group, every topic that we take a look at is to show real people, to show real people in their element, especially as artists, showing what these people have achieved in their lives, and what contributions they've made to our community. We're so excited, for instance, to welcome Kumuhina to the event on Friday night. She's a Mahu activist, mm-hmm. And sort of is dealing with this being of Native Hawaiian ancestry, a Mahu, the third gender in Native Hawaiian culture, but also being a modern-day trans person. And so I think if people can sort of come and hear her story in person, it humanizes this whole group of people, and I hope will then bring empathy.
When you talk about how life experience erodes prejudice, a life in the arts, almost all arts, including yours as a singer, are collaborative.
Oh, absolutely. And it makes you realize how rich the world really is and how important all these differences really are. It would be such a boring place if we were all the same. And all these differences come together in the arts to make for a very broad and very interesting and very rich art form, you know, art world. And we would not be able to have the same kind of interest in what we do without that.
Well, when any of us as artists collaborate with others and are boosted by when our own creative efforts are boosted by that collaboration,
yeah.
you do get an appreciation of the people who got you there.
Absolutely.
Right? If you're in an ensemble, for example,
absolutely,
you feel a very strong feeling
yeah.
of comradeship.
That's right.
Everyone who helped you make that piece of music.
The arts really bring people together. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then when you see that person for the person that they are, and they also happen to be, you know, gay, or they also happen to be black, or they also happen to be, you know, an immigrant. That sort of gives you then a different perspective on that person.
Well, we need, you know, we need reasons, most of us, to understand and appreciate other people. It might be a weakness of ours that we need those reasons, but it's kind of human nature.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. Yeah, and when we have these reasons, when we see these people for the sort of the value that they bring, that can really affect our whole view on the group. And hopefully, the point of our events is to then bring empathy into the community in general.
And when you say events, you mean you're planning
That's right.
others.
Yeah, so we started with an immigration event that you and I talked about back in March. We
right.
had a climate change event in May. We're looking at doing an event for Women's History Month in March. So, yeah, we are continuing along this path of building compassion, empathy, and love in the community.
Well, keep in touch.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Rachel. Rachel Schutz is a performing artist and founder of Artists for Social Justice. She's one of the performers in Arts in Conversation LGBTQ+ this Friday at 7:30 in the Orvis Auditorium on the UH Manoa campus. It's free and open to the public. You can learn more on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we give the White House some advice on fighting terrorism and basic incompetence.
If the government is good at things, I can tell you this, they're not good at this.
Can politicians and eggheads play nice together? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7.
Time to look at activities going on in our state that are under the radar with Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Chris. How are
There's
you?
A talk on Sand Island coinciding with a Bishop Museum exhibit all about voyaging tradition.
Right. Yeah. The exhibit is called Holo Moana, Generations of Voyaging, and it opens in November. But this talk centers on the planning of the Hokulea's Malama Honua Worldwide Voyage. It's from 6 to 7:30 tomorrow in the Marine Education Training Center on Sand Island. And for ticket information, please go to our website.
I imagine a fair amount of learning, planning went into a worldwide,
of course,
around the world
sailing
project,
around the world,
project, right?
What they did, man.
And I've always been fond of strange musical instruments. I've never heard of the ektar before. What is that?
I just learned about it 5 minutes ago.
All right, you're way ahead of me.
The ektar is a one-string instrument used in Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan to play traditional music. Gwen Jones will perform other instruments from around the world, including the didgeridoo, Balinese flute, and Tibetan bell. So, yeah, it'll be a learning experience as well. It's from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. tomorrow in the Kealakekua Library.
And Leonardo DiCaprio played in the film, played a character and lifelong imposter in the film Catch Me If You Can. The real man will be lecturing tomorrow in Mo'ili'ili.
Yes, his name is Frank Abagnale, if you saw the movie. And he's considered the world's leading expert on outsmarting con artists. And that's because he was once one himself. Now he's joined forces with AARP to help you learn how to spot and avoid scams. And this event is free tomorrow in the Japanese Cultural Center from 6 to 8 p.m. For registration information, please go to our website.
Yeah, he's reportedly impersonated an airline pilot at one point and a doctor, which is a little bit scary.
I know, to be operated on by.
To have, you know, to be able to do that and get away with it. But I guess that's why, to set a thief to catch a thief, right?
Right.
Thanks very much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, Sherry Kajiwara, Director of the Department of Consumer Services, tells us how the city is dealing with a growing situation of abandoned and unclaimed vehicles. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.